The sermon title I gave to Nancy in preparation for the service was Setting the Precedent, but I liked the other one I had, and I almost didn't use it. The title was Behind Every Good Man is a Surprise Mother-in-Law. Shane liked that one especially, yes, right? There was a woman who had been married for just over a year and was visiting her mother-in-law. And the mother-in-law noticed that the young bride was wearing her wedding ring on the wrong finger. When asked why this was, the daughter-in-law said to her, "For the first 6 months of our marriage, I wore the ring on the right finger, but after that, I started wearing the ring on the wrong finger." "Why did you change?" the mother-in-law asked. Well, the young woman answered, "I changed my ring to the wrong finger when I realized I was married to the wrong man." Now, I hope that with this little story, I'm not giving a whole lot of you ideas about any reorganization of your wedding rings. I don't want to do that. I simply tell this little story to raise the facts that quite often when we get married, our spouses or marital relationships turn out to be nothing like what we imagined. It's also true that quite often life's circumstances go in a direction we never imagined with our spouses. How many times have we heard someone, or even said ourselves maybe, that their spouse was not the same person that they had married? You ever heard that? I bet there's not one person here who is or has been married whose married life turned out the way they thought it would in the months leading up to their wedding day. All kinds of things can change one's circumstances and either enhance or add stress to a marriage. Employment changes, health issues, financial stress. And no one can ever anticipate how children can absolutely turn our lives upside down. I have a friend who years ago used to say to me all the time, he knew children brought changes into one's life. He just didn't know how many involved diapers. I ran across this little tidbit about marriage this week. It said, marriage is the process of finding out what kind of person your spouse would have preferred. Now, we joke about incompatibility, or in the case of family law, irreconcilable differences, but the issues are very serious, aren't they? Many people cope very well with having their anticipation shattered, but still there are others who cannot live with the reality that their spouses, the reality of their spouses, and the death of the fantasy. And in reaction to their shattered expectations, they divorce, or heaven forbid, especially in this part of the world, they actually find some violent end to their spouse, or seek some violent end to their spouse. I raise this subject with you considering some recent court decisions regarding divorce settlements and child custody cases that have been in the news. But more importantly, because our gospel lesson for me raises a very important lesson or question. When Peter and Andrew, James and John left their nets at the seashore and followed Jesus, what was the reaction of their families? Now, I know in the Chosen series, they try to suggest a reaction, but I'm still going to ask the question. Mark Buchanan, in his book, Hidden in Plain Sight, a great read, by the way, imagines what it must have been like for Peter's wife to have Peter gallivanting all over Galilee with Jesus and leaving her alone. Now, I can't share with you Buchanan's work today, but suffice it to say, I believe it could not have been easy for this woman. It must have been very difficult for the rest of the family when one member makes a commitment to follow Jesus. It's even possible this morning that some of you in this room have experienced that tension, and maybe you still do today. All of us know people who have spent years delicately balancing their family life with their religious convictions. So are there lessons that we can learn from Peter's experience? Well, let's look a little closer at the lesson we have today. It begins, as I said, at the end of that worship service and the Sabbath day when, as we examined last week, Jesus healed a man who was demon-possessed and they were in the synagogue. Do you remember that? And the whole town was buzzing with rumors and excitement about Jesus. Now, I know there are practical reasons for Jesus to go to Peter and Andrew's home after synagogue. Jesus needed a place to stay. He needed physically to get some food. So Peter offers Jesus hospitality. Now, it's not quite clear whether Peter knew his mother-in-law was sick before they went to the home. We don't know that. But the issue hit them as soon as they walked in the front door. It was the central issue of that home at that moment. Some scholars at this point like to stop and explain family dynamics that were quite different in Jesus' day, and they were. Not only were women considered second-class citizens in much of Jesus' world, a widow, as Peter's mother-in-law is assumed to be, would have been considered by many people as an unwanted burden. As a widow, Peter's mother-in-law would have no source of income. And what is interesting is that normally in that culture, a widowed mother went to live with her son's family, as it was his responsibility. Remember Jesus on the cross with his mother Mary? So we can assume, therefore, that maybe she had no sons, or the sons were unable to care for her. So without any other options, she comes to live with her daughter, Peter's wife. The home in question would have been Peter's family home. And being the older brother, it was probably had probably been left to him, maybe when his father passed on. Andrew was still likely a resident in the home because it says he went home with Peter and Andrew. And maybe Andrew wasn't married yet, but we really don't know for sure. I know I'm in a great deal of danger of reading a bit into the passage, but I can't help but thinking that Peter and Andrew really wanted to bring Jesus home so their family could begin to get an understanding of the decision they made. Maybe the family was in great upheaval over the disruption of their neatly ordered lives, and Peter sought to bring some resolution into the problem. Now, if we know anything about Peter, it's that he's impulsive, right? Peter said and did things often without thinking, and we've gained a great deal of spiritual insight because Peter was impulsive. Maybe this intention to follow the Galilean preacher was just one more impulsive action by Peter. I know I'm reading into it, but I can imagine Peter's wife and mother-in-law hearing about Peter's going off with Jesus and just rolling in their eyes and saying, "Here he goes again. Look, and this time he's dragged his brother Andrew along with him." And questions in that family would have abounded, like, who's going to catch fish to make money? And let's be honest here, Peter traveled with Jesus for weeks at a time. And Peter's wife would get lonely, right? Surely she would have her mother and maybe children if they had any, but it just wasn't the same as having her strong, forceful husband Peter there with her. Someone she had come to love perhaps and depend on. So the healing of Peter's mother-in-law may have been an act of mercy. As for one more reason why Jesus did it. Not only did the sick woman have her unnamed illness relieved, but I suspect that Peter's household would have acknowledged that, oh, well, hold on a minute. Maybe Peter and Andrew weren't so foolish after all. Perhaps there was some truth to what Peter had been talking about when he said that this Galilean was the Messiah. The plot thickens as the sun goes down. And I remind you again that this trip to Peter and Andrew's home was immediately after the Sabbath service in the synagogue. Remember, we're on the Sabbath. So Peter's mother-in-law was healed on what day? Sabbath. Which, as we will see later in the Gospels, was a real issue for the Pharisees, wasn't it? Once the sun went down, however, the Sabbath is over. And the locals begin to arrive en masse at Peter's house. The people of Capernaum have been present when the demonic man had been healed at the synagogue. And so they were anxious to bring to Jesus their sick friends and their sick relatives. They waited until the sun went down because that, because that means the Sabbath was over and there'd be no prohibition against the physical work of carrying a sick relative to Jesus. Read that Jesus responded with great compassion to the crushing need that was now pressing at Peter's door. Maybe now Peter's family are beginning to understand or begin to see why Peter was so excited and why he took this commitment to follow Jesus. We read that when the crowds had been satisfied and the household retired for the night, Peter and his wife, I can imagine it, probably laid there in bed having a serious discussion of the events of the past few days, because all married couples know that the heaviest conversations happen after you go to bed, right? You know this? Perhaps she was overwhelmed, and I'm sure she had tons of questions. But the die had been cast, and Peter was about to become the rock on which much of the world's faith and practice was to be built. Salvation, therefore, comes to Peter's home in response to Peter's radical obedience to Christ's call. The call being, of course, to become fishers of people. All of this raises the next lesson for Peter's family and the lesson for all of us. What exactly is the nature of the enterprise to which Peter is being called? The scriptures continue that very early in the morning, before the sun was even up, Jesus went away to pray. And Mark tells us that he went away into the wilderness, which is an odd word to use here, very odd. You see, the area around Capernaum was heavily cultivated by that point. There was a lot of population in those days. Josephus, the historian, tells us that at this time there were farms everywhere. And there were people everywhere. So why say that Jesus went away to the wilderness to pray when he didn't go miles away? Mark is making the point about the nature of Jesus' work. The word wilderness harkens back to the introduction of Jesus' ministry in chapters 1 and verses 2 and 3, and also to Jesus' experience in the wilderness at being tempted. In Mark's account of the gospel, the nature of Jesus' work is hammered out in the metaphorical wilderness, or more literally, in isolation and prayer. Biblical scholar William Lane points out that Mark is perhaps indicating that the crowds at Peter's house actually drove Jesus to solitude. That perhaps the clamoring crowds seeking healing was a temptation leading Jesus to abandon his true mission. Same mission that Peter was called to. You know, healing ministries are a real popular draw, aren't they? They bring in huge crowds into stadiums and arenas. We see modern day healers like Benny Hinn all the time on television, healing supposedly hundreds of people. And seeing people healed of all manner of infirmity, well, that's really exciting, isn't it? To be able to do such a thing or to be associated with someone who could heal like that, well, that would really lend some prestige and authority to a person. The Gospels are full of people seeking relief of their immediate physical needs from illness and even hunger. Who wouldn't want to follow someone who would heal and feed the multitudes? However, I think many people needed to hear this point very clearly. Jesus' mission, might surprise you, was not to heal as many people as possible. No, it wasn't. That's not why he came. The healings were a sign or a side effect of the greater work of the kingdom that was going on. So when Peter finds Jesus and he was away praying and tells him that the crowd is longing to get more healing from him, Jesus responds with a very defining statement of purpose. We must go on to other towns as well, and I will preach to them too, because that is why I came. Hear that? Jesus' mission then was to preach the kingdom, meaning that he was to go about calling people to decide about the claim of God on their lives. Jesus' focus was on the spiritual condition of the people that he met, a point that is underscored in reference to verse 39, that Jesus is mentioned expelling demons along with preaching, spiritual conditions. But he makes no mention of physical healing. You notice that? The same point is made, isn't it, in Luke 5, the story of the paralytic man who is lowered down through the roof to be healed by Jesus. Remember that story? What is the very first thing Jesus says to the paralytic man? Verse 20 reads, "Seeing their faith, Jesus said to the man, 'Son, your sins are forgiven.'" It's only when the Pharisees accuse him of being blasphemous that Jesus actually turns and heals the man of his paralysis. Once again, as I stated last week, the problem of humanity lies in the souls of people. Certainly, the pressing immediate needs of our physical natures requires attention, but the primary importance to Jesus, and by extension, his church, is the care of souls. In the midst of physical pain and suffering or even emotional pain, all we really want is relief, right? Just as the paralytic man sought. However, the greater need always remains the soul. Tony Campola, I quote him a lot, tells the story of a street person who was standing on the corner of Wall Street in New York City begging for money. Common sight there. He was reaching out his hand. He pleaded with passing corporate executives with the words, "Change, change." And the story goes that one executive responded with a very pained expression on his face, "I'm trying, I'm trying." That's the point of Jesus' ministry. Change. Change of allegiance. Change of purpose. Change of heart. Change from death to life. That's what Jesus is preaching about. It's what he wanted his disciples to understand. And that's what was built on the rock that Peter represented. There's no place for status quo in God's kingdom. And Peter eventually understands this change meant leaving his past and moving on to more important matters. But what about his family? It still comes back to me. What should our response be when the work of Christ brings change to our loved ones' lives? Thankfully, we know what Peter's wife's response was. Did you know that? 1 Corinthians chapter 9. The apostle Paul is defending his authority as an apostle, and his companions writes to live as normal a life as possible, when in verse 5 and 6 appear these words, "Don't we have a right to bring a Christian wife along with us as the other disciples and the Lord's brothers and Peter do? Or is it only Barnabas and I who must work to support ourselves?" You hear that? It's clear from what Paul is saying that Peter's wife became part of the traveling missionary group, part of that early church. At some point in Peter's transition to apostle, his wife embraced the change and the mission Peter was called to. Sure, she was still a fisherman's wife, but Now the prize catch was people, not bass. I'm sure like many saints who have followed their spouse into Christian service, well, she had her struggles, sure. She had her questions, but she saw the greater prize. And I'm beginning to think that Peter's wife had a profound impact on Peter's thinking, and also, and I know that from reading 1 Peter 3, 1-7. I can't help but wonder when Peter penned these words that they're really a tribute to the woman who stood with him and journeyed with him for Christ. Peter wrote this to wives in general, but I see his wife written all over it. Peter says, "Don't be concerned about the outward beauty that depends on fancy hairstyles, expensive jewelry, and beautiful clothes. You should be known for beauty that comes from within, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is so precious to God. That is the way holy women of old made themselves beautiful." So while it may be true that behind every good man is a surprised mother-in-law, it's also true that behind every good servant of God is a spouse who possessed enough faith to see the hand of God on their beloved and a willingness to join in the great adventure God is calling us to.